Would you be interested in telling us about what In the Wake is about and where you're coming from with it?
Okay, sure. Well, I have to start with some of my motivations about where I got the idea to work on this project in the first place. And as long as I can remember, I've been aware of that degree of ecological destruction and human exploitation that's happening in the world. And then as I grew older, I became increasingly aware of it and more desperate because of all of the interrelated systems of exploitation, because civilization, if you want to call it that, or the corporations, the state, all of the interrelated institutions and all of the industrial infrastructure and military infrastructure works together to support each other and to create the sort of world that we've ended up living in, a world where 90% of the fish in the ocean have been killed in the past 50 years, a world where countless species have gone extinct, a world where 1 billion people live in slums and that sort of thing. And I always was trying to figure out, you know, how can you change this horrible system? And I became, well, rather despairing because of the fact that everything was so interrelated. It didn't seem, you know, that you could change everything, or you said you could change anything without changing everything. But because of the fact that these systems are so gigantic, it's sometimes overwhelming to think about changing all that. And then increasingly over the past couple of years, I was reading more and more about the energy situation, about peak oil. I don't know if many people are aware of what peak oil is, but I'll go into a brief backgrounder.
That's great.
We all know that there's not an infinite amount of oil. Oil is a finite commodity, and our civilization is based on a finite commodity, which makes it by definition unsustainable because eventually it's going to run out of that. But most of us aren't aware to the extent of which the oil supply is going to, you know, if the lack of oil is going to impact us in our lifetimes. And that's because the number of discoveries of oil have been decreasing significantly over the past few decades. It was in the 60s when the peak of oil discoveries were made. Since then, people have been discovering fewer and fewer oil reserves. They're discovering less and less oil underground. We're using oil about four times as fast as we're discovering new supplies of oil right now. And that means that we are soon going to start having less and less oil, very soon, in fact. If you look at the work by people like Richard C. Duncan, who've plotted the oil production versus oil discovery graph over the past 50 years or so, they've decided that we're probably going to start running short pretty soon. And that's something that we've actually known for a long time. There was a geologist named Hubbert who came up with something called Hubbert's curve, which was basically a bell curve of oil production. That when you start drilling an oil well, it produces a little at first, and then more and more and more until it peaks and then starts producing less and less and less. So this applies to any individual oil well, and it also applies to oil production in general. So the consensus among retired and independent petroleum geologists seems to be that the supply of oil production, or the oil production, is going to be peaking probably around this year or next year. So from now on, civilization is going to have less and less oil available, less and less energy available every year than it did the year before, which is unprecedented because throughout the history of our civilization, the history of Western civilization in Europe, civilization has always managed to expand. It's always managed to find more energy supplies by going further and getting more wood, by digging more coal, by traveling across the Atlantic and committing genocide in the Americas to gather their resources. But it seems to have reached its energy limits. And there are a lot of hopes for certain people about renewable supplies. I'm not going to go into that right now, but the energy renewable supplies like solar power and wind power and that sort of thing would, in a best-case scenario, only offer a tiny fraction of the amount of energy that we currently use. And I'll get into why that's important in a minute. But I also want to talk about natural gas, because a lot of the feedstock for industrial production, like fertilizer, synthetic fertilizer, synthetic pesticides, that sort of thing, comes from natural gas. And natural gas production works a little bit differently from oil production because of the way that oil and natural gas move through the porous earth. Because natural gas will seep through the pores in the earth very quickly. So instead of having a gradual decline from a natural gas well, as you'd expect from an oil well, you actually have a very sudden decline, and that's the supply of natural gas is exhausted. So you go from peak production to almost zero production very quickly. And there's a lot of evidence that that's happening now in North America, and that in the next couple of years we'll see a drastic decline in natural gas production. And as people know, if you have gas at your house, it's already become significantly more expensive over the past few years. And that's certainly irritating for housing, and it's dangerous for people who don't have enough money to pay for heating in cold climates like ours. But because of the fact that so much of agricultural production is based on the use of synthetic fertilizers, it means that agricultural yields may start to drop as fertilizer becomes more expensive and scarce. And it's worth noting that already agricultural yields, even in the best years, are starting to fall short in some areas. For the last 4 years, the planet has eaten more grain than it's produced. That's because grain stockpiles from previous years are being depleted. And that has a lot to do with industrial expansion as well, because the water tables are dropping in many parts of the world, in the American Southwest, in China, at extremely rapid rates because of industrial agriculture pumping more and more water in order to increase the production of the land, because also because of more pollution and the expansion of cities, the quality and size of agricultural land in many areas is decreasing. So you see in places like China, all of a sudden, they are unable to produce enough rice to feed their population. Last year, China went to importing rice, which is something pretty incredible, considering that China has been an agricultural civilization that's been self-sustaining for thousands of years. You know, there's a phrase, for all the rice in China. And all of a sudden, because of their rapid industrialization, they're having trouble meeting their own food needs. So the fact that the energy available is decreasing is also going to lead to a decline in the amount of food that the industrial system can produce, which is pretty serious.
I think that's very serious, especially for us in northern climates when we have a shorter growing season.
Exactly.
So much of everyone's food comes from South America or Africa or California.
Uh-huh. And because of this global system where we have food that's being produced intensively with machines and being transported over great distances, the energy required to make 1 calorie of food is 10 calories of oil energy. So it takes 10 times as much energy to produce food as you get out of eating it, which means that if you were working, if we had all of the tractors, you know, run by bicycle tractors and all the food from California was biked, if it all came from human power directly, you'd end up working for weeks just to feed someone for a day. Mm-hmm. And so that means in the long term, as we know, the industrial agriculture system is not sustainable. It's not going to feed everybody. Mm-hmm. And that has implications for people's livelihoods in the long term, because we can start growing some of our own food to help make up for the decline in industrial agriculture production. But that's very difficult in cities that are as large and dense as they are now. Because, I mean, how many people in Toronto have a backyard where they could grow any food, let alone enough food to make a significant impact on their needs of food?
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any cities anywhere that are preparing for this?
Well, not really. There are certainly cities that are engaging in something of a shift. I think that some of the best examples of things that can be done technically might actually come from Cuba, because Cuba was saddled with an oil embargo some years ago and an embargo of other industrial products by the United States. So since then, Cuba has had to adapt to some of the circumstances that we're talking about. So biking is very common in Cuba. You know, they've sort of integrated mass transit with the biking system, so they have flatbed trucks that will bring bicycles into town from outlying areas. And they have a lot of urban agriculture and permaculture, and they have very creative organic agriculture systems.
Hmm. Anything in North America at all that you know of?
Well, not that I'm aware of. There are certainly a lot of creative creative experiments going on in terms of eco-villages.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some really amazing stuff happening out on the land. But I haven't seen a lot of things happening in cities. I think, for one, people aren't very aware of this because it's not very well known. Some people might have read, you know, Richard Hindberg's The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, but it's not something you see on the news. What I recently spent the summer doing was I biked across Canada and spent a lot of time looking at different eco-villages and farms and self-sufficient communities to see the sort of plans that they were implementing. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly suggest to people that it was an excellent experience, and I learned a lot. And doing that sort of thing is a really good way of looking at different opportunities. But I think on the whole that the decline in industrial capacity is going to happen more rapidly than most people expect, and probably too rapidly for a lot of that kind of preparation to take place.
Mm-hmm.
I would encourage people to, you know, to have links with a farm and that sort of thing that they could participate in if there were a more drastic decline in industrial production than we might expect. And a lot of the next booklet that's coming out is going to cover suggestions for people to prepare and to work towards being more self-sufficient, to have their community be more self-sufficient.
Hmm. I remember reading an article by Michael Rupert talking about oncoming economic Armageddon, as he calls it. And his suggestions were to free ourselves from debt as soon as possible, get to know as many neighbors as possible, learn how to grow your own food, and learn how to be as self-sufficient as possible in terms of energy consumption, energy use, and retrofitting the home and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And those are pretty important suggestions that anyone living in a town or city can take action on right now.
Yeah, it's true.
And I have an interesting question for you. If you were presented with a magic button that would just erase every single human being from the planet, including yourself, would you press it?
I don't
know. Rid this planet of humans?
I probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
And maybe I think that's because I still have hope that human beings, or at least some human beings, will come to a more sane way of living and a way that's more cooperative with other people. I know a lot of people who would press that button, but I have to say that I wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
at least not right now. If there was a button that would eliminate industrial civilization, I would press that button.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I still have some hope in human beings.
Hmm. So yeah, you spoke earlier of faith and that so much of our industrial civilization and our society rests upon faith in the benefits that capitalism promises and faith in authority and whatnot. But what do you have faith in?
Well, it sounds a bit strange to say that I have faith in industrial collapse, but I do. A lot of my premises, a lot of the optimism that I feel is based on the idea that this way of life can't last much longer. I know that there are some people like the Unabomber, like Ted Kaczynski, he did the things that he did because he believed that civilization could last for hundreds of years, and that it was going to continue and become this increasingly surveilled and technological sort of Big Brother scenario where people were controlled by advanced computers and that sort of thing. And he acted that way because of that belief, because mm-hmm. of that desperation. And I guess I have more hope that civilization will collapse. And I have some hope that people will start to find themselves and find communities that are sustainable, that are equitable. And maybe that hope is ill-placed. Mm-hmm. And looking at historical examples, I mean, historically, healthy communities have been systematically massacred by civilizations as they spread across the face of the planet. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's a poor hope. And I know that writer Derek Jensen, who wrote A Language Older Than Words and A Culture of Make-Believe, is pretty down on the whole idea of hope. I think that he defines hope as a belief in a future condition over which we have no agency. So we hope that something will happen, but we don't actually, but it's something that we can't do anything about. You know, he mm-hmm. says, I don't hope that I'm going to eat breakfast. I just eat breakfast because that's something that he can do something about. But Derek believes that hope can stop people from acting effectively because they have this false hope, or that they rely on something that they can't do anything about, so they don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I can certainly see where he's coming from. I don't use quite the same words, but...
Mm-hmm. And there's something else I was going to say. I forget right now. It certainly is exciting, though. A friend of mine last night used the metaphor that he imagines perhaps in the collapse of industrial civilization, a lot of people will be walking around rubbing the sleep from their eyes if they're just waking up from a bad dream.
Uh-huh.
And I like that image. And I look forward to the day when, because it's always disasters or bad weather or whatever that brings people together, like the blackout of last summer or a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
Neighbors actually began talking to each other. There's always some kind of removal of the norm which creates communication between people, and I certainly do look forward to that.
It's true. There are movies like Mad Max and that sort of thing which portray this complete dystopia in the future where everyone is fighting for themselves and just trying to kill other people to loot whatever resources they can. And I think that's a projection of how corporations act and how civilizations and states act, put onto future. But mm-hmm. I think that most people don't act that way naturally. I think that people participate in systems like that because they don't perceive it or can't see any other choice.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to think that when people are put into a situation where they're closer to the land and closer to each other, that they'll start coming awake, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really good example. I remember there was an article, I think it was in the Globe and Mail, by Rick Salyutin called Blackout, A Case for Anarchy,
mm-hmm.
which was all about how the fact that people, you know, seem to get along just fine without any government or effective policing or that sort of thing over the period of the blackout and got along better. And it's also an example in places like Argentina, where the economic collapse there has produced all sorts of cooperatives and communities and creative resistance that I don't know if people there could have imagined during the fascist rule that was happening during the decades before.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. And from here, Eric, we're kind of running out of time. I have 15 minutes left on the show, and I got to talk about a couple of things. And I'm not sure. We maybe have a couple more minutes for any last words, if you'd like.
Okay, sure.
Any sending words, if you want to, like, once again, tell people how to find out more about your project.
All right, that's great. Well, you can go to my website. It's www.inthewake.org. And it also has references in the bibliography to other works that people can look at that include a lot of the premises that this work is based on. You know, I can't go and prove all the premises that In the Wake is based on, because then I'd just be rewriting the work that those people had done.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage people to read things by Derek Jensen. He wrote A Language Older Than Words and The Culture of Make-Believe. He just wrote a book called Endgame, which is about the collapse of civilization. And it's I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be published, but there's a reading club online that people can subscribe to and read that before. And I would also encourage people to read more about peak oil. Richard Heinberg wrote a book called The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. And that's an excellent introduction to the topic of peak oil. He also wrote a book called Power Down, which is about options and actions for a post-carbon world, as he puts it. So that includes a lot of things that people can do about peak oil itself. And there's another book called The Oil Age is Over by Matt Savinar. And you can go to his webpage, lifeafterTheOilCrash.net. So I would encourage people to read more about the situation, and hopefully if people aren't aware of the severity and urgency of the situation already, reading things like that will spur them to action.
Hmm. Yeah, very much thank you for coming on the air, Eric. It's truly, truly important and urgent to get this stuff out there and to prepare, and a lot of people are already preparing, and I thank you for sharing your ideas.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you again.
Wonderful.
And once again, thank you very, very much.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You as well.
Bye.
Goodbye for now.